Isaiah began proclaiming Yeshua to be the Messiah. He had already ascended to heaven. They did not have any book of the New Testament to start with. Yet many Jewish people were convinced based upon the use of the Hebrew Bible. And they had to make use of the Hebrew Bible because at the time they began, there was no John 3:16. So let's turn for a moment to Luke chapter 24. Luke 24. Look at verse 25, Luke 24 and verse 25. And he said unto them, O foolish men, and slow of heart to believe in all that the prophets have spoken. Behooved it not the Messiah to suffer these things and enter into his glory? And beginning from Moses and from all the prophets, he interpreted to them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself. So after Yeshua's resurrection, what he did was to these disciples on the Emmaus Road, show to them that the things that had caught him by surprise that seemed to militate against his previous claims to be the Messiah actually become evidences of it. And still later in verse 44, chapter 24, verse 44, and he said, these are my words which I spoke unto them while I was yet with you, that all the things must needs be fulfilled which are written in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms concerning me. Then he opened he their minds that they might understand their scriptures. That the Hebrew Bible has three divisions, the Torah, the Nevi'im, the Ketuvim, the law, the prophets, and the writings. And notice here in verse 44, all three divisions are accessed. He showed his messianic claims from the law of Moses, from the prophets, and the book of Psalms as the part of the book of the writings. And from all three divisions, he was able to convince them that what caught him so by surprise with his arrest and all that happened thereafter, all are evidences of his messiahship, not a negation of it. Let's turn to the book of Acts, chapter 8. Acts, chapter 8. Acts 8, verse 35. Acts 8, verse 35. And while the Ethiopian eunuch was reading the scroll of Isaiah, was reading through chapter 53. Notice in verse 35, and Philip opened his mouth and began from this scripture, meaning Isaiah 53, preached unto him Yeshua, using the very scroll that was already in the hand of the Ethiopian. Now let's go over to chapter 17 of Acts 17. Verses 1, 2, and 3, verse 1. Now when they had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where was a synagogue of the Jews. And Paul, as his custom was, went in unto them, and for three Sabbath days reasoned with them from the scriptures, opening and alleging that it behooved the Messiah to suffer and to rise again from the dead, and that this Yeshua, whom said he, I proclaim unto you, is the Messiah. Here again, no John 3:16, not quoting any New Testament passage, but strictly using the Hebrew Bible. Many Jews are convinced that he was the Messiah. Go to chapter 18 and verse 28. Chapter 18 and verse 28. Is somebody running the PowerPoint? Because it should be in the next slide by now. Chris? Okay, chapter 18, verse 28. For he powerfully refuted the Jews, and that publicly, showing by the scriptures. And again, the term at this point is only referring to the Hebrew Bible, that by the scriptures that Yeshua was the Messiah. Go to the last chapter, chapter 28. And verse 23, chapter 28 and verse 23. And when they had appointed him a day, they came to him into his lodging in great number, to whom he expounded the matter, testifying the kingdom of God, and persuading them concerning Yeshua, both from the law of Moses and from the prophets, from morning till evening. So as we look at the New Testament usage before the New Testament volumes were being written, they were able to convince many people, Jewish people in particular, that this Yeshua was indeed the Messiah. Now, capital B, in dealing with the different categories of messianic prophecies, let me point out that there are four different categories. First of all, there are those that speak only about the first coming, only about the first coming. And this would be the main focus of the study this afternoon. The second category are those that deal with the second coming only. The second coming only, but we'll not be dealing with those specifically in this study. A third category is when the first and second coming are blended into one picture without any indication in that text that there's a gap of time between the two comings. And one example of this would be Zechariah chapter 9, verses 9 and 10, Zechariah 9, verses 9 and 10. Where verse 9 speaks about the first coming when he rides upon the donkey into Jerusalem. Verse 10 speaks about the second coming when all weapons of war are removed from the land of Israel. And in that passage, there's no implication there's a gap of time, now 2,000 years long, between verse 9 and verse 10. We know there's a gap of time from other passages, but we do not know it from that passage. And so the third category is when the two comings are blended into one picture without any indication of a gap of time in between. Now the fourth category is that has a prophecy that contains his whole redemptive career. And by his whole redemptive career, it includes four things. Number one, something about the first coming. Secondly, the gap of time in between. Thirdly, the second coming. And fourthly, the messianic kingdom. And Psalm 110 is a good example of this fourth category. There's something about the first coming, something about the gap of time, something about the second coming, and then the messianic kingdom. The capital C, the importance. One very important reason to study such this topic is it avoids some types of certain kinds of oversimplifications. Like a common saying is that the Old Testament believer looked forward to Messiah's death, and the New Testament saint looks to the back of Messiah's death. That's really an oversimplification. Because you have to remember, the Hebrew Bible was not revealed all at one time. Between the first and last book, about 1,000 years would transpire. So what the people could know based upon divine revelation was based upon how much had been revealed up to that point. Now the fact that Messiah was died was revealed in the days of David in Psalm 22, but that passage says nothing about the reason for his death. And you will not know the reason for Messiah's death until Isaiah is the prophet in Isaiah 53 and verse 10, you shall make his soul an offering for sin. Only then was it possible to know Messiah would die specifically for the sins of Israel. Ultimately later in Isaiah 49 earlier, he would also die for the Gentile world as well. So to keep in mind, how much could he know about the Messiah based upon how much had been revealed up to that point of time? And the assumption that the Old Testament saint from the very beginning knew Messiah would die could not be evidence from the scriptures that was available at that point of time. Another oversimplification, that during his first coming, he fulfilled 300 prophecies. 300 prophecies. I've heard that many times, and every time I ask someone to give me a list of those 300 prophecies, nobody can do it. That's really an oversimplification, an overabundance of a simplification. We have a lot of evidence enough in the prophecies to know he's the Messiah, but we should be careful how we number some of these. So let's go on to Roman numeral 2, the examples. We're going to try to focus primarily on the examples which are not so common. Isaiah 53 is very common. If time allows, we'll cover some others as well, but for now we'll limit ourselves to those on this outline. You can turn now to Genesis chapter 3. Genesis chapter 3. In this chapter, it is recorded how man fell, and so this chapter also contained the first prophecy of the coming of the Messiah. There's a story that one day Adam came home from work, and Eve asked him a typical wifely question, "Adam, do you love me?" He said, "Who else?" There was no one else. Now the story is that after the expel from the garden, Eve developed this very suspicious attitude, and she thought maybe God would make a new wife for Adam and she won't know. So every time Adam came to bed, she would count his ribs to make sure none are missing. Now let's notice to whom the first messianic prophecy was addressed to. It was not given either to Adam or Eve, but addressed specifically to Satan in verse 15. "I'll put enmity between you and woman, and between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel." So in this prophecy, what Satan is told, that a time will come when a descendant of the woman that he tempted and brought sin into the human sphere is going to someday come to defeat him. Now the question is, how was this early prophecy understood? One example that we can look at is chapter 4, verse 1. Chapter 4, verse 1. "And the man knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bare Cain, and said, I've gotten a man." And this ASV renders it, "with the help of Jehovah." But the phrase "the help of" is in italics, which will tell the reader that phrase is not found in the Hebrew text. The construction actually points out is, "I've gotten a man, colon, Yahweh, Adonai, Jehovah." And what she understood from that prophecy shows that God himself was going to enter the human realm to bring about the redemption of Genesis 3:15. Just the translators cannot believe that she could have that much insight, that much knowledge, and therefore insert the phrase that changes the meaning of the verse. But if you have a good rendering, good translation, you have something on there, but it should be in italics to let you know it is not in the Hebrew text. In fact, the same construction is found in verse 2, "and again she bare his brother, colon, Abel." And both these words, both the name Cain and the name Abel, are preceded by one Hebrew phrase, actually two Hebrew letters doesn't translate into anything, just it's the sign of the direct object of the verb. And the direct object of the verb in verse 2 is Abel, and the direct object of the verb in verse 1 happens to be Cain. So she has some kind of a concept of a God-man. Let's skip down to chapter 5 and look at verse 28. Chapter 5, verse 28. "A Lamech lived 182 years and begat a son. He called his name Noah, saying, this same shall comfort us in our work, in the toil of our hands, in which comes because of the ground which Yahweh," which Jehovah, "had cursed." Now the cursing was a result of Adam's fall and spoiled the Adamic covenant. But when Lamech gave birth to Noah, he recognized Noah was going to be used in a very unique way by God, and probably made the assumption that his son will prove to be the Messiah. Now, he was correct in that God intended to use Noah in a special way. That much was correct. But Noah was not going to be the Messiah. We understood the Messiah, when he comes, would remove the Adamic curse that fell upon the earth back in Genesis chapter 3. So you have some indications of how that prophecy was understood in the pre-Noahic flood stage. Now, keeping in mind, the first prophecy was addressed to Satan. That helps to explain what happens in chapter 6, verses 1 through 4, because what you have here is a group called in Hebrew B'nai Elohim, sons of God, and everywhere else in the Hebrew Bible, the term B'nai Elohim always refers to angels, good or bad, always refers to angels. There's no good reason to make this the one exception to the rule. And the phrase, the daughters of men, focuses on the female portion of humanity. So what's happening here is that Satan, as many of his fallen angels, take on human form. Whenever angels appear in human form, they always appear as young men, often mistaken for young men. And he has them intermarried human women, producing a new race of beings, which in verse 4 is referred to as the Nephilim. Now, King James rendered this by the word giants. That's unfortunate because the Hebrew word for giants is the word anakim, A-N-A-K-I-M. The word Nephilim from the root nephal means a race of fallen ones, a race of fallen ones. So what's happening here is that there is an intermarriage to try to corrupt the seed of the woman. The Messiah cannot arrive. And what they produced was neither angelic or human, but rather the mixture which made them superhuman insofar as strength, insofar as human mental abilities, but they're not necessarily huge. Now, why did King James choose to render the word giant? Sometimes the King James rendering was based on the Septuagint, which was a Greek rendering of the Hebrew Bible done about 250 BC. And when the rabbis who rendered the Hebrew Bible into Greek needed some kind of a Greek term for the Nephilim, the best Greek term they could use is the word gigantes, G-I-G-E-N-T-S. G-I-G-E-N-T-S, gigantes, is a Greek term from which English term giant comes from, but in Greek it was not referring to giant big people. Rather, in Greek mythologies, you have sometimes gods marrying with human women, sometimes goddesses marrying with human men, as not really marrying, but having sexual relations, and they produce a child that would be superhuman, like Achilles, whose only weak point was on his heel, that later would render him to be killed in the war. And so the King James rendering giants was based upon the Greek meaning, but it doesn't carry the same meaning into English. Would have been better for them to just say Nephilim, as my rendering does here, and other Bibles now make it. Was giving people the impression that these were big giants. That's not the case here. And he came very close to succeeding in corrupting the various seeds of Adam, which were more than just two seeds, but a number of seeds by this point of time. But one seed remained pure, and so by means of the Noahic flood, he destroyed the whole humanity and the product of the Nephilim. And therefore, there was a line that was not corrupted, and the messing line could therefore continue. So, from the overall context, it was understood that Messiah will somehow be the God-man born of a woman. And he's the one that would remove the Adamic curse. As you move into the Abrahamic covenant, you learn that the seed of the woman, which means he could come out of any segment of humanity, will come only from one segment of humanity, and that will be Abraham. And then the Abrahamic covenant was confirmed only through one of Abraham's eight sons, and that would be Isaac. And then was reconfirmed to only one of the two sons of Isaac, and that is Jacob. And then was confirmed in Genesis 49 through all 12 sons of Jacob, and so the 12 sons fathered the 12 tribes of Israel. And so the seed was being narrowed more and more a bit. Son of the woman, son of Abraham, son of Isaac, son of Jacob. And now look at Genesis 49. Genesis 49. In chapter 49, verse 10, Genesis chapter 49, verse 10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until Shiloh come. Unto him shall the obedience of the peoples be. In dealing with the tribe of Judah, with their son Judah, and Judah was the fourth one born. But his firstborn son was disqualified to carry on the firstborn line because he slept with one of Jacob's concubines. And the second and third son were the ones who slaughtered the whole city of Shechem, and therefore they got disqualified. And so the firstborn privilege is going to be given to Judah, insofar that from him will come the royal house of Israel. So here we learn that the Judah was the one that's going to produce the messianic line. And therefore, it shows that the Messiah will be a king. And so, that narrows the seed a step further. But as far as this goes, he can come from any of the families of Judah. But in the Davidic covenant, it'll be narrowed another stage further. It has to come from the family of David. So the Messiah will not be of any family of Judah, but only of the Davidic family of Judah. Now when Genesis 3:15 refers to the Messiah, the seed of Dumim, that breaks the biblical norm because generally the line was always traced to the male line. If you look at the genealogies we have in the Hebrew Bible, which are quite a few, and also two in the New Testament, it is the male line that is being traced. Women are either never mentioned. If they are mentioned, they're mentioned in passing, not directly relevant to genealogy. But we're all being told why. When Moses records what God said to Satan, the Messiah will be of the seed of the woman, we're not told why. And we're not told why until Isaiah's time. And Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14, Isaiah 7, 14, we're told that whenever the Messiah is born, he'll be conceived and born of a virgin. And that finally helps to explain why with the Messiah, you only have the seed of the woman, because all of us here have two biological parents. All of us here are a biological father and a biological mother. But the Messiah, his entire humanity, comes from only one source, and that is the source of the mother. Therefore, with him, you have no choice. You have to trace his line to be the seed of the woman, not the seed of the man. Now, this is not in the outline. Let's just turn to one more passage within the Torah and turn to Deuteronomy chapter 18. Deuteronomy chapter 18. Deuteronomy chapter 18, verse 15. And Jehovah your God will raise up unto you a prophet from the midst of you, and of your brethren like unto me. Unto him you shall hearken, according to all that you desire of Jehovah your God in Horeb, in the day that of the assembly, saying, let me not hear again the voice of Jehovah my God, neither let me see this great fire anymore, that I die not. And Jehovah said unto me, they have well said that which they have spoken. I will raise them up a prophet from among their brethren, like unto you. And I'll put my words into his mouth, and he shall speak unto them all that I command him. It shall come to pass that whosoever will not hearken unto my words, which he shall speak in my name, I require of him. What we learn here is that besides being a king, as we saw already in Genesis 49:10, another office he will hold will be the office of a prophet. But notice what kind of prophet? A prophet like unto Moses. Not just like any prophet, like Isaiah or Jeremiah, specifically a prophet like unto Moses. Now, what was the nature of the prophetic office of Moses? Now, go back to Numbers chapter 12. In verses 1, 2, and 3, you have a rebellion of Aaron and Miriam against Moses because they didn't like the woman he had now married. And they claimed to have equal prophetic skills. So in verse 4, Jehovah spoke suddenly unto Moses and unto Aaron and unto Miriam, come out, ye three, unto the tent of meeting. And they three came out. And Jehovah came down in a pillar of cloud and stood at the door of the tent and called Aaron and Miriam, and they both came forth. And he said, hear now my words. If there be a prophet among you, I, Jehovah, will make myself known unto him in a vision. I will speak with him in a dream. My servant Moses is not so. He is faithful in all my house. With him will I speak mouth to mouth, even manifestly, and not in dark speeches. And the form of Jehovah shall he behold. Wherefore then were you not afraid to speak against my servant, against Moses? And there are many prophets to follow Moses, but notice the uniqueness of the prophetic office of Moses. With Moses, God spoke face to face, mouth to mouth. And he even got to see not God as he really is, but in the form of God, the Shekhinah, the Shekinah glory form, was able to see on the second climb to Mount Sinai. And so that will be the uniqueness of the prophetic office of Moses. The Messiah will be a prophet like Moses and not like the other prophets. So if all we had was the five books of Moses, how much can we know about the Messiah? What can we know about him? Number one, he'll be the seed of the woman. Secondly, the seed of Abraham. Thirdly, the seed of Judah, Jacob. Fourthly, the seed of Judah. And that facet also says he'll be a king. He'll also be a God-man, but also to be a prophet like unto Moses. There's only an implication of a virgin birth based upon Genesis 3:15, It's only an implication because it's not really clear till Isaiah 7:14 is penned. Okay, let's move on now into the prophets, and we'll go to Isaiah chapter 9. Now, chapter 7 through 12 is a specific unit within the book of Isaiah, 7 through 12. It can be called the book of Emmanuel because that name appears three times in the Hebrew text. It appears only twice in English, but it appears three times in the Hebrew text. And the first time is with the virgin birth, virgin conception, virgin birth of the Messiah in chapter 7, verse 14. And later in chapter 8, Isaiah points out that when Emmanuel finally comes, he'll become the new point of division between the remnant and the non-remnant. And the favorite prophetic term for the Jewish people who believe was called the remnant of Israel. And Isaiah uses that phrase frequently. And the non-remnant was Jewish people who choose not to believe. So in chapter 8, he points out two things. First of all, in his day, what distinguished between the remnant and the non-remnant is the attitude towards Moses and the prophets. And the remnant consisted of Jews who believed in Moses and the prophets, whereas the non-remnant pursued idolatry, occult practices, and so on. But the second point he makes is that when Emmanuel arrives, he will become the new point of division between the remnant and non-remnant. For the remnant, he'll be the sanctuary. For the non-remnant, he'll be a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense. And both Paul and Peter quote this verse in showing that in their day, this prophecy was being fulfilled. And that's the background as we come to Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder. And so far he points out, focusing on the humanity of this Messiah, that he's the one destined to have the authority of the government placed upon him. For the second part of the verse, he is given four names, three of which clearly show deity. For example, the second name and the third name are the obvious ones, the Mighty God, and often it reads in English, Everlasting Father, more correct, the Father of Eternity, not Everlasting Father, but the Father of Eternity, the one who gives eternal life. Now, the first name is Wonderful Counselor, which in English does not imply deity because we use the word wonderful for both God and man. You might hear me say how wonderful God is. You'll hear me say how wonderful my wife is. But in classical Hebrew, there were certain words which were used only of God, either what God is or what God does, never used of any human being, of what a human being may be or may do. For example, the Hebrew word for create, bara, B-A-R-A, B-E-R-A, is a Hebrew word used in the Hebrew text only of something God can do. And so in English, we do speak of people being creative, but in Scripture, no human being is creative. Only God can be creative. The same thing is true with the Hebrew word for wonderful, pele, P-E-L-E, P-E-L-E, pele. This is a word that is used of something only God can be, and nobody else can be this wonderful. So in English, it does not imply deity. In Hebrew, that's all it can mean. Now, the exception to this is the fourth name, Sar Shalom, Prince of Peace. That's a term that can be used in Scripture either of God or of man. But within Isaiah's own prophecy, that is a term that is used of God elsewhere, though other prophets use it of human beings. So you put the two parts of verse 6 together, you have a clear messianic God-man concept. And in verse 7, this is the one that's going to someday sit upon the throne of David and ruling in the messianic kingdom over the people of Israel. And the verse ends, the zeal of Jehovah of hosts will perform this, and God's zeal to fulfill every prophecy he's ever given us, he will fulfill it. So whatever prophecies have remained unfulfilled up until now will be fulfilled in the future. But in this passage, a very clear God-man concept. Should be on page 2 of your outlines. Let's go now to Isaiah chapter 11. Now verse 1 reads, there shall come forth a shoot out of the stock of Jesse, and a branch out of his root shall bear fruit. And the rest of the passage deals with how he will rule in the messianic kingdom. But this first verse is a bit more relevant to the first coming. What he points out is the arrival of Messiah will come only when certain other things have occurred. And that is, the house of David has been reduced to what it was in Jesse's day. And so the pictures of a mighty tree, a strong tree that represents the house of David, but now the tree has been felled. All that is left is a stump, and it seems to be a totally dead stump, unable to do any reproduction. And only as a dead stump does a shoot or branch begins to grow at very lower the root. When you think of David, you think of a warrior and a king. When you think of Jesse, you think of a poor shepherd family in Bethlehem. And when the Messiah arrives, it'll be when the house of David has been reduced to a poor shepherd family. And so it was, and when the Messiah was 40 days old and they brought the offering for the firstborn, what they offered, Joseph and Miriam offered, was the offering of two birds, which was a poor man's offering, an offering allowed only if you could not afford anything better. And that shows that the couple was poverty stricken at that point of their lives. Okay, let's move on now to chapter 49. You have a passage about the servant of Yahweh, servant of Jehovah. Now, Isaiah's favorite term for the Messiah is this term, the servant of Yahweh, the servant of Jehovah. He used the term servant in three ways altogether, sometimes Israel as a whole, as a nation, sometimes of the faithful remnant, the Jewish believers within the nation, but the most common use in these chapters is specifically of the messianic person. He begins that aspect in chapter 42. And he picks up here in chapter 49. So verses 1 through 4, he describes the Messiah being in a depressed state because of Israel's rejection of him, which would imply his mission ending in failure. And the best way to fit this in historically as a fulfillment was this was part of his agony of Gethsemane. And while the Gospels focus on one facet of his agony, This one focuses on a different facet of his agony, Israel's rejection. Now look at verse 3 for a second, and we'll deal with that with the following passage. He said unto me, "You are my servant, Israel, in whom I will be glorified." Now, in all ancient Jewish writings dealing with Isaiah 52 and 53, unanimously, well into much later beyond the time of the Talmud and so on, any reference to Isaiah 53 was viewed as being messianic. They didn't believe Yeshua was the Messiah, but they did view that prophecy to be messianic. That began to change. And the first one to change that was Rashi in about the 1000s, where he said that Isaiah 53 is not speaking of the Messiah, it's speaking of Israel as a servant. That did not gain wide acceptance, and even Maimonides or Rambam, when he wrote his commentary in Isaiah, says, "I am shocked that that Rashi broke away with Jewish tradition and rendered this as being Israel. I will stay with the rabbinic tradition that this refers to the Messiah." Only in the 1800s did that become the more general view among the rabbis and the synagogues. And they use this as evidence in verse 3. Here it says, "Israel, in whom I will be glorified, you are my servant Israel. Therefore, the servant is Israel and not the Messiah." But they don't keep reading the next several verses. Now, a message will come to the Messiah at this point of time, and in Luke's account of the agony of Gethsemane, it comes by means of an angel. And the angelic message is in verse 5. "And now says Jehovah, that formed me from the womb to be a servant, to bring Jacob again to him, and that Israel be gathered unto him. For I am honorable in the eyes of Jehovah, and my God has become my strength." Now notice in verse 5, after referring to the Messiah as being named Israel, in verse 5, part of the mission of Israel, the Messiah, was to also regather the people of Israel. So yes, one of the messianic names of the Messiah is Israel, but there it's individual. And you get to verse 5, this individual Israel is the one that is to bring again to God Israel the people, Israel the nation. So when Israel is used collectively, it would be the people. When Israel is used individually, it would be, in this case, the one, the Messiah, but that's the only passage that's used that way. In Isaiah 53, it's used individually, not nationally. And in verse 6, yeah, he says, "It is too light a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to restore the preserved of Israel. I'll also give you for light to the Gentiles, that you may be my salvation unto the ends of the earth." And what the message is, that Israel's rejection of the Messiah did not catch God by surprise. It was very much part of the divine plan. In the divine plan, the Messiah would come, he'll be rejected by his own Jewish people. As a result of that rejection, he'll become the Or LaGoyim, the light to the Gentiles. And over a period of time, there'll be Gentile salvation. Now, when Yeshua addressed the apostles in Acts 1, verse 8, he told them to go begin their ministry in Jerusalem, then move on to Judea, then go on to Samaria. He does not mention Gentiles, but he uses the phrase unto the uttermost ends of the earth. But that was already an idiom, as you see here in the Hebrew Bible, here in verse 6, that is a phrase, an idiom for the Gentile world, that you may be my salvation unto the ends of the earth. And so you have a first coming followed by the rejection, therefore it becomes the light to the Gentiles. Then in verse 8, "Thus says Jehovah, in an acceptable time have I answered you, in a day of salvation have I helped you. I will preserve you and give you for a covenant of the people to raise up the land, to make them inherit the desolate heritages. What he points out here, eventually Israel will come to him. And when Israel comes to him and they are saved as a nation, then he'll restore the land to the people, he'll restore the people to the land. And you look at in Paul's Israelology in Romans 9 through 11, he has the same basic outline as you see here. Now seeing what he said in verse 8, go back to chapter 42. Isaiah 42, verses 1 through 6, he introduces the messianic servant. He's pointing God is coming to benefit two different groups. So in verse 1, behold my servant whom I uphold, my chosen whom my soul delights, I have put my spirit upon him, he shall bring forth justice to the Gentiles. And so here we learn that the Gentiles are included in the messianic mission. Now skip down to verse 6. I have called you, I Jehovah, have called you in righteousness and will keep and will hold your hand and will keep you and give you for a covenant of the people and for light to the Gentiles. So notice Messiah, the servant, is to benefit two groups. He's to be the covenant of the people, singular, because he will be the one to fulfill all of the covenantal promises God made to the people of Israel. But secondly, he's also to be a light to the Gentiles. What we do not know from this text, is this going to be done simultaneously or chronologically? So now from going back to chapter 49, we learn that's going to be done chronologically. Israel reject him, so he will initially become the light to the Gentiles for a period of time. And in Paul's words, once the fullness of the Gentiles becomes in, then all Israel will be saved. Israel will come to him. And then in verse 8, notice it'll be the covenant of the people. Only then will he fulfill all of the unfulfilled covenantal promises God made to the Jewish people, which in verse 8 includes bringing the people back to land and giving the land back to the people. Okay, let's turn, let's take one before we take our offering and take our break. Let's go to chapter 50. Another one of his servant songs. The Lord Jehovah had given me the tongue, this is verse 4, the Lord Jehovah had given me the tongue of them that are taught, that I may know how to sustain with words him that is weary. He wakened morning by morning, he wakened mine ear to hear as they that are taught. And what he points out, this is something we don't even learn from the New Testament, we learned this from this Hebrew scripture, that as the Messiah is going up in the early hours, in the wee hours of the morning, the Father will awaken him and take him aside and begin to disciple him, to train him for his messianic mission. So besides receiving a Jewish education in a spiritual Jewish home, but also the synagogue school that he would have attended, he received private tutoring by God the Father. And that's why by the age of 12, he clearly understood his sonship relationship with God the Father. So in verse 5, even when he realized that his mission will include a lot of physical sufferings, he did not rebel against what he was being taught. When the day of his agony began and continued in verse 6, he gave his back to the smiters. He didn't try to shield the back from the Roman whip. And he did not try to shield his face from those spitting into his face and pulling out his beard, because he had been privately tutored by God the Father as he grew up. And he was ready to do exactly this very messianic mission. Let me just mention a couple of books in the back table. What we've done over the years is put together a detailed study of the life of the Messiah from a Messianic Jewish perspective. It was a 40-year travel. We put this out in four volumes, which are white covered, and it gives you all of the rabbinic ancient quotations from the Midrashim and the Targumim and the both the Jerusalem Talmud and the Babylonian Talmud. And it gives you all of that information, and we can see why the origin of many elements in the New Testament. Most people don't read those big books anymore, so we produced a one-volume set, which is the abridged version. As far as the treatment of the Gospels, it includes the same material as the four-volume set, but doesn't give you the sources, doesn't quote the many rabbinic quotations and so on, and this just gives you the straight elements of what is being taught. And this book called The First Day of the Messiah goes to the prophecies of the Bible. There's a separate book on first coming prophecies called HaMashiach, what the Hebrew Bible teaches about the Messiah. But this is dealing with second coming prophecies. So it uses the book of Revelation as a base and brings in all the other scriptures from both testaments. You can tell what order these prophecies are going to be fulfilled. So these are two good volumes to get a hold of at the back table. What we're going to do now is take an offering for Ariel Ministries, and this offering is to help to defray. Hopefully somebody got assigned to take them. Okay, it's coming. And while that's coming, I'll give you one of my rabbi stories that I hope I hadn't told you here. It's a rabbi story that comes from Helm. Helm is a town in Poland. And what Jewish communities elsewhere around the world have a reputation for being intelligent. That was not true with the Jews of Helm. They were not known to be particularly intelligent. And one example that given in the stories that come from Helm is part of a book by Isaac Basheva Singer, The Wise Men of Helm. The rabbi read about people doing ice fishing. He'd never heard of this before. Now, Poland has many lakes with many kosher fish. He decided to try to do some ice fishing and didn't want to do it alone since this was new for him. So he got one of his elders from the synagogue to go with him. They found some ice and began cutting a hole. All of a sudden, from on high, they heard this voice. There's no fish below that ice. They're startled, and the elder says, what was that? Rabbi says, I don't know what that was, but makes me nervous. Let's just go somewhere else. So they begin to go elsewhere and cutting a second hole. And once again, they heard the voice, I said there was no fish below the ice. Rabbi asked the elder, do you think maybe that's God speaking? And the elder says, I don't know if it's God, but if it happens again, you better ask. You're the rabbi, you should be the one asking if that's God. But let's just go somewhere else. And they go to a third part of the ice and start cutting a third hole. And once again, they hear the voice, one more time, there's no fish below the ice. And finally, the rabbi got up his courage and asked, is this God speaking? No, this is the manager of the ice skating rink. Okay, let's take a break for about 10 minutes.